Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. Back to work with a bang. We're going to bring you right up to date with all the news stories we didn't get time to discuss from the past week and the holidays. It's a show filled with nanotechnology, how the future will shape our careers, and trouble at the Royal Institution. We're also going to speak to Emma Townsend about Charles Darwin's dogs. And a look ahead at 2010 and what can we expect from scientists. What about those disappointed environmentalists as well? This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Welcome everyone. In the pod with me today are The Observer's science editor, Robin McKee, and The Guardian's environment correspondent, David Adam. Hello guys.
Hello. Hello.
Now, it seems like a long time ago, but how were your holidays? Did you make any resolutions for the new year?
Drink.
Resounding silence.
I'm going to stop drinking.
You're going to stop drinking. Maybe. How long has it lasted? It's been just 2 weeks now, so has it lasted?
I haven't actually stopped drinking yet, but I'm going to soon.
At some point you'll stop drinking. Maybe when you're in a coffin, you'll stop drinking.
My David. New resolution is for Robin to stop drinking.
Okay. Well, I'm glad that you're keeping to that, both of you. Now, this past month has been dominated by environmental news. What with those pesky politicians refusing to agree to any deals to cut the world's carbon emissions at Copenhagen? But we're going to ignore all that and take a break from discussing climate policy. Instead, we're going to mull over some of the choice stories from the past few weeks and perhaps a few favourites from last year as well. Robin, let's start by talking about one of the UK's venerable scientific institutions. This is the Royal Institution, headed up until recently by Susan Greenfield. It's in a lot of trouble. Tell us more.
Yes, it is. The trustees have eventually decided that they no longer need a scientist as director and have therefore made the Baroness redundant. It is in quite a financial state at the moment. Basically, a huge amount of renovation work was done there, and it is not entirely obvious where the money to finish off these bills is going to come from.
So the Royal Institution, the famous place where Faraday did his lectures, Humphrey Davy was researching there, many chemical elements were discovered, the Christmas lectures are held there. This is not a small thing that it's in. It's teetering on the edge of collapse.
It is an incredibly important place. It is sort of the original place. For 200 years, it's been science for the masses. You know, the same that the Royal Society didn't get around to actually having women as fellows, as members until the 20th century. The Royal Institution 200 years ago was having, you know, these lectures that were there for poorer people, for women, at a time when, you know, these sort of things were not done. It has an incredibly important role to play in science today. The trouble is, it is having a great deal of difficulty raising money, and the Baroness has been fingered as the person who was responsible for its financial woes and has been made to pay the price.
Well, let's talk about her a bit. Baroness Susan Greenfield sort of divides opinion amongst scientists and anyone who likes the idea of science. I mean, she is loved by many because she's a powerful woman who's got to a very successful position, professor of neuroscience at Oxford, head of the Royal Institution, very prominent, used in the media a lot. But then there are lots of scientists and commentators who think that what she says sometimes is doesn't have evidence behind it. For example, she complained that computer games were destroying young people's brains or changing them in some way, or that she uses her prominence unduly. She's never been elected to the Royal Society because it seems the Royal Society fellows were up in arms about the fact that she has no scientific record. I mean, what's her role in all of this? Because she's been made redundant.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's crucial. This is all about, you know, Susan Greenfield. It's not about really the state of play at the Royal Institution. And yes, when she took over 11 years ago, she got rid of a lot of cobwebs there. But in the end of the day, she's antagonised too many people in the establishment. And while she's there, there is a problem about can it raise more money, that money it needs. And the fellows, the trustees, I should say, have taken the view that got to go.
David, would you miss the Royal Institution disappearing?
Well, I think I would. But I think thinking about the Royal Institution, with Robin there saying how relevant and important it is, I think in a way people like the idea of the Royal Institution without actually using it that much. I think it's sort of a nice cosy reassurance. It's a nice link to our past, and it obviously has been very, very important. But I would actually question the relevance of it in today's society. And I think that, which is a shame, actually. And maybe that is an indication of perhaps Susan Greenfield hasn't had the impact that perhaps she thought that she would, or perhaps other people thought she would.
Well, this is the question. What is its role now, given that there are things like the British Association or the British Science Association, which tries to communicate science. There's the Royal Society, which is moving into a more of a policy role with its...
You've got the Wellcome Trust just along the road there in Euston Road, with a tremendous track record of innovation and getting people in for these events that they have. It's concerned, of course, with medical science. There's nothing like that going on at the Royal Institution. And if you look at the Royal Institution Christmas lectures, under Susan Greenfield's leadership, they were, a major Christmas event on British, BBC One. Now, where is it? It's on More 4. Now, that is, that should never have happened, and that's an appalling fact that it's nothing against More 4, but I mean, it's buried, and there it should be in, a lead feature in the Radio Times at Christmas time and things like that. But no, it's disappeared.
Let's move on now to Neanderthals. Now, there's some research published just a few weeks ago on the fact that Neanderthals actually used makeup and wore jewellery. This might not be that interesting to many, many, many people out there, but it does highlight one thing, Robin, which is that we give Neanderthals a bad rap. We think of them as sort of cavemen that beat each other up and don't really communicate very well, but they had all sorts of interesting things going on.
Yes, I mean, don't forget, they survived some 4 ice ages in Europe, between 300,000 years ago and to about 30,000 years ago. So they've got to be sophisticated in that sense. And were they just great, brutes with cudgels that killed, mammoths? No, I think there's lots of evidence that they were a bit more sophisticated at that. The trouble was just they weren't quite as sophisticated as Homo sapiens.
Which is the result now. But what does the fact that they're wearing jewellery makeup actually mean evolutionarily?
Well, it means they're thinking symbolically. It suggests it's thinking symbolically, and they're not, just living for the moment, for the instant, and that they're capable of some kind of planning and some long term strategic thought.
So more than just whatever I need to do for this afternoon, I'm going to get some food, or I need to do whatever.
Exactly.
Yeah. And one of the scientists involved actually said that this proves that they've got the dyes they had. Proved their evidence, gave evidence of mining, transportation, ability to work to complex recipes. So quite a sophisticated sort of mini society.
Yes, of course, whether they were looking and watching what Homo sapiens were doing and learning from our example is kind of not clear from this.
Yeah.
Did they actually think it for themselves?
Or did they just copy, yeah?
Yeah.
Just to wind up there, again, one of the researchers there is sort of trying to point out this issue about Neanderthals getting a bad rap. And he said, my view is that there's absolutely no scientific justification to consider Neanderthals as the brutish half-wits they've been portrayed as in popular culture, which has also, to an extent, influenced scientific thinking. It was high time, he added, to banish our cavemen prejudices. Even if they were a bit different in behaviour and cognition, they were as human as their contemporaries, who we call our ancestors. I mean, maybe our ancestors were just as cavemanish and brutish as them.
They did live in caves, right?
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. And there was very little difference. We just had a slight edge, and over generation, we slowly, accrued that advantage until we'd probably, garnered all the good hunting grounds and good places to get, fruit and vegetables. And
history is written by the victors, after all, and those who can write.
Yeah,
that's very... And those who can write. And that was Homo sapiens, unfortunately, for the Neanderthals. David, let's move on to nanotechnology, sort of ancient and modern now. There's a report published by the House of Lords Science and Technology Committee into the use of nanotechnology in food and drink. Now, I didn't know that there was much going on in food and drink, so what kind of stuff is it being used
for? Well, this is the point of the report. The Select Committee criticises the food industry for being very secretive about both its research into nanotechnology and its use of nanotechnology. And actually, I tried to do a bit of research for this and just had a quick look around on the web, and it is quite difficult to find out exactly what's going on. So I think they probably have a point. Certainly, there is interest... I mean, we should maybe explain nanotechnology just means very, 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 very small.
1,000th the width of a human hair.
All of it. It's all that size. Yeah. And so the food industry is interested because it allows them to do things that either it can do at the moment and it's quite expensive, or it could even allow them to do things that it can't do. And they're interested in all sorts of things, from agriculture and growing the food to changing the way that you can process the food and make it feel and make it taste, right through to packaging. There's talk about these smart packaging that can detect when the food is going off. You don't need a sell-by date anymore. But what the report warns is that, well, hang on a minute, there's not enough openness and transparency about this. And that's not in itself a problem, but where it could be a problem is if we get a repeat of the whole GM scenario, where there's a total breakdown in trust between the public and the industry, and so they're calling quite early on for a bit more of a of an open dialogue, I suppose, and a bit more transparency about what's happening.
So the idea is that we members of the public know that there is nanotechnology in there, what nanotechnology is, and what it's doing, and they can make their own minds up before it gets to a sort of scary Daily Mail front page.
I think so, and probably also a more thorough exploration of the risks and the. The problems that might be associated with it, even if those are very, very small, to at least give people an informed choice.
I mean, and it was interesting that it was actually one of the scientists on the panel, it was John Krebs, former chairman of the Food Standards Agency, because he's a proponent of technology when it comes to foods. I mean, he's a proponent of genetically modified techniques, for example, which, again, were in the news last week because John Beddington, the chief scientist, the government's chief scientist, has been saying that GM is going to be crucial if we're going to be tackling things like climate change and food shortages. I mean, Robin, is he right?
Yes, absolutely. But I mean, he's talked about this perfect storm of climate change, rising water levels, water shortage. Basically, we're going to have less water and less land to grow more food for more people as we're getting hotter and hotter. To turn our backs on any kind of technology that helps that would seem to be quite ludicrous.
Well, let's move on now to what I think is probably the most interesting of the stories in the last couple of weeks. Published in Nature, it was a fossilised footprint of a tetrapod, which raised quite a few questions, Robin, about when fish might have crawled out of the water.
Yes, because it seems to have happened about 18 to 20 million years before it should have, if you see what I mean. We have the idea that fish crawl out the water on their fins, which will slowly evolve into legs, and you get, you know, basically this is the beginning of animal life on land. And, you know, it was supposed to be about 375 million years ago. This pushes it back another 20 million years. Shows you how very little we know about something that we're apparently so certain about, that this is how life on land began.
Obviously, as you said, this pushes it back by 20 million years, when the animals came out of the water, but also raises some other questions, including perhaps why they came out of the water in the first place.
Yes, I mean, there's the idea that you're in a sort of area and it's drying out and the pools are separated. And so to get from one pool, the fish may crawl out and start using its fins as legs, or possibly it was laying its eggs on land to avoid fishy predators, because the land was much safer. So again, it started crawling itself out onto beaches, and again, the process began that way. So we don't really know why we left the water and took to the land, and given that it was a move of such enormous consequence, it would be quite nice to have a better, clearer idea.
This is one of those rewriting textbooks things, isn't it? Well, this isn't the end of the story either. They could find another fossil.
Yes, they could push it back even further. Yes. Well, great. That's what science is about, you know, overturning paradigms and theories.
Well, there's a fantastic video of this tetrapod on our website. If you go to guardian.co.uk/science, so you can have a look at how this thing actually tried to move around. And also the interviews with the scientists are on that thing as well. Now, I was going to talk about a story written by Ian Sample about a few weeks ago on dark matter, but it's quite fantastically complicated. I'm not sure that without him it will make much sense to me. So I just encourage our readers, listeners, to go and have a read of that on the website. It was sometime in December. It was by the CDMS experiment at Fermilab in Chicago. So off you go to that. Now, before we wind up this section, David, Robin, what were your stories of last decade, the noughties? What was the thing that really stuck out for you?
Well, when I was a kid, I read the book Firefox, and what I really liked about Firefox was this was a plane that was developed by the Russians, and they sent someone in to steal it, someone who became Clint Eastwood in the film. And what I really liked about the Firefox plane was it had this thought-controlled weapon system. You could just think about shooting stuff and the plane would do it. And it seemed so fantastic to me. But in the last decade, we've actually got somewhere towards that technology, not with a weapon system, clearly, but on a far more beneficial sound. We've now got a technology that allows a brain implant that can be used to track people's thoughts, and it can perform quite rudimentary moves, but it can do it. And so in sort of the middle of the decade, I remember we wrote a story about a guy who'd been paralysed in a very nasty attack, and they gave him one of these implants, and it allowed him to He couldn't move his arms, couldn't move his legs, but he could move a cursor around on a screen just through thinking about it. He could just think about moving it one way or another. And the technology mapped his brain activity and it turned that into a movement. And then only last year or so, we actually saw the next step of that, where some guys in Japan made it into being able to move a robot around. You could actually move a robot arms and legs and make it walk around. So I think that's really exciting technology and something that, once again, fiction foresaw in a way, and sort of science is catching up.
Robin, what was your discovery of the decade?
Well, my discovery is Homo floresiensis, the hobbit man of found in Indonesia, which is a wonderful discovery. There's a little race of people that existed till 15,000 years ago. I say a race, they're a different species from Homo sapiens, probably a different species from Homo erectus, who we thought were the only people who had actually made it out there from Africa to Indonesia, maybe something far more primitive than we ever thought could have left Africa. They've got the brain the size of chimpanzees, but they made stone, quite complex stone tools. Challenges what it means to be in our idea of what it means to be an intelligent hominid. Challenges our ideas about how hominids left Africa. Challenges just about every kind of predilection and every thought we'd had about human evolution.
The discovery itself was challenged too. I mean, there was a lot of controversy over whether it really was another species of human or just a human with a sort of disease of some sort.
Yes, and that controversy has rumbled on, I think, really in the last couple of years, though. It has been nailed down. Most human paleontologists accept that this is a genuine species of hominid.
Okay, well, we'll leave that stuff there. Lots more on these and loads of other stories at guardian.co.uk/science. Was, in case you're asleep, the year everyone celebrated Charles Darwin as much as possible. It would, after all, have been the year he turned 200. In case you're missing him now, we're going to dip into a bit of Darwin with Emma Townsend. She's a journalist, lecturer and musician, as well as being the daughter of The Who's Pete Townsend. She looked at how Darwin's dogs helped shape some of his ideas. We sent canine aficionado Andy Duckworth to meet her.
Well, first of all, for people that don't know, tell us about what dogs Darwin had.
Darwin had a whole succession of dogs. His family had dogs even when he was a little boy. The dogs were a real focus of family life. And then as it went, after he got married, he and his family and his children owned lots of a succession of family pets as well, who were both well loved but also featured in quite a lot of his scientific thought.
Was he particularly fond of the dogs, particularly close to them? Yeah. What was his relationship?
Yeah, he really doted on the dogs. And it's funny because in some ways his life is kind of bookended by two dogs in particular. There's a dog that he owned, Spark, when he was a young man, and that dog was a real kind of one of those boyhood, his sort of bosom friend. And then the last dog he had in his life, who was called Polly. Both of those two dogs were really, really important to him. But all the other ones in between as well. I mean, he was a great one for fostering dogs of people who were having problems with the dog but not behaving properly. And he would always have dogs from people who were moving somewhere where they couldn't take a dog.
What was the influence of these dogs ending up in his theory of evolution? You know, were there any links there?
In terms of the dogs ending up influencing the theory, I suspect, and I think there are other people who feel roughly the same way, that Darwin's experience of his childhood, of growing up in the countryside in Shropshire, of being around farm animals and, you know, and in a context where agricultural shows and trying to improve the breeds and keeping breed record books and stud books and trying to win the rosette for the fattest pig, that growing up in that context has been somewhat underestimated in having shaped his vision of a theory of evolution in which natural selection did act in a way that's a good analogy is a breeder. That natural selection acts as a good breeder would do, picking out traits that it would be a good idea to have preserved, and then breeding from those.
What did he discover about canine behavior in particular? What kind of things did he come up with?
There's kind of two elements to his work on dogs. One is that he uses the dogs as sort of an analogy. So in The Origin of Species, you'll find that in the first section of The Origin of Species, which talks about artificial selection, i.e. selection done by human beings, you'll find the dogs crop up there. As an example, he talks a lot about greyhounds and breeding an ever faster greyhound. So that's using the dogs as an analogy for how his theory of evolution works. After he writes The Origin of Species, and obviously we're all familiar with the idea that the evolution becomes a very, very controversial subject in Victorian society. It's very, very problematic. And lots of people come to a sort of accommodation with evolutionary theory. Even people like Darwin's close friend, Charles Lyell. Charles Lyell was high church. His accommodation that he comes to with evolutionary theory is he goes, okay, I can believe it happened for the animals, but human beings possess many, many special characteristics like being able to love, being selfless, acting in a self-sacrificing way that animals don't have. And the reason that we have those is because we have a soul that we've been given by God, and that there must be a separate moment of creation for human beings. So Darwin now has to tackle a sort of fallback position. He has to go into battle against that fallback position. And at that point, dogs come back into the argument, because Darwin, at that point, uses dogs and other what he calls higher animals as a way of arguing that we share all of those behaviours with members of the animal kingdom. And in the book The Descent of Man, which comes out 10 years after The Origin of Species, he really tries to tackle the problem of people saying, okay, I accept that evolution happened for animals, but I don't accept it for human beings. He's saying, no, there's an absolute continuum in the behaviour of animals. And, you know, he'll pick out Newfoundland dogs that save lives. He picks out dogs that will lick another animal that's sick. It's not just dogs he uses as an example, but lots of the examples come from dogs.
And how have you written this book? What research did you do? And how did you go? How did you go through it? And what new things have you found?
Well, the thing was that I started off wanting to write this book because I didn't imagine in any way that I could somehow contribute to the huge pile of Darwin books that there were going to be this year in any sort of really magnificent way. What I really wanted to do was, I was aware that there were people, like, for example, my mum, who will never read a whole book about Darwin, even though I knew that she would find it interesting if she actually did read a book about Darwin, she'd never get around to it. And she'd be daunted by the idea. So my criterion when I was writing this book was to write a short book. It's much shorter than a normal popular science book could be, like 80,000 words, and this is 30,000, and it's got lots of pictures. And all those things were really important to me because I wanted to use the dogs as a way of telling readers who are like my mum, who might be a bit put off by the idea of reading a straightforward biography, to use the dogs as a way to kind of tempt people in. So it was quite important to me. I spent quite a lot of time even just researching the pictures, finding really nice old Victorian prints of dogs and stuff like that, because I wanted it to be quite a tempting book to hold. But also, my background is that I did postgraduate work in history of science, and I worked a lot on ideas about how scientific theories come into popular culture. So that to me was interesting as well, to try and think about how you convey Darwin's ideas to a popular audience. So in terms of research, I spent a lot of time just reading through all his letters. That was quite a big part of it. There's an enormous and really brilliant, complete set of all of Darwin's work online. There's two separate resources, both of which I give the references for in the back of the book. But there's all of Darwin's correspondence and then all of his writings as well.
I've read the review that Nature published of your book, but perhaps most importantly is, what did your mum make of the book in that case?
My mum was very complimentary, but I think most people would go, well, of course she's going to be. What was really nice was she rang me up, and because I gave her a kind of proof copy over the summer, and she rang me up and she goes, I've just explained the theory of evolution to somebody that I'm on the beach with. And they understood what I meant, and I understood what I meant. It's one thing to read a popular science book and you feel really clever at the time. Do you know what I mean? You can read one of these sort of Martin Rees books, like, or Brian Greene or something like this, and you're like, yeah, I totally understand it. But it's another thing to go away and explain it to somebody else and still feel like you've got your head around it. So that was a moment of great delight to me.
That was Emma Townsend, author of Darwin's Dogs, speaking to Andy Duckworth. Her book is out now. Before we get to the future-gazing part of the show, a quick heads up to the upcoming Science Book Club. Next month, we're discussing the classic Guns, Germs and Steel, in which Jared Diamond puts forward a compelling explanation for why civilizations developed explosively on a few continents, but stagnated everywhere else. Our seasoned reviewer, Tim Radford, will kick off the discussion on Friday, 19th of February. As always, everyone is welcome to join in at guardian.co.uk/science/blog. Robin, David, have you read Guns, Germs and Steel? Is it on your to-do list forevermore?
No, I've read it, yes. I think it's
as good as everyone says?
Yes, it is a lovely explanation of why the Spaniards invaded South America and people of South America did not invade Spain. It's basically the playing field wasn't level, and it's better to be living in Europe and Asia than it was to live in a country that's on a north-south axis.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk with Alok Jar.
Okay, well, onto that crystal ball now. What's in store for 2010 and indeed for the rest of the decade? Can we expect to have solved all the problems in physics, come up with cures for everything using stem cells, or will climate change have started its devastating effects, meaning we'll start moving to caves and civilization starts to fall apart? Okay, Robin, let's talk about space first. NASA, this is a really crucial decade for NASA. We don't really know what's going to happen to the space exploration in the Obama years yet still. So what's in store for this venerable institution?
Well, the very short term, what's in store for it is kind of the end of the space shuttle. The last flights will take place this year. And by the end of this year, the space shuttle will be mothballed. A fabulous machine in many ways, but crucial strategic problems with it. And what comes afterwards, we don't know. We have absolutely no idea.
The Ares rockets are sort of being tested, but haven't been successfully tested yet.
There's been one test firing that's been all right. The question America has to ask itself is, why does it want to be in space and where does it want to go? And these are questions that are almost unanswerable.
But really, NASA was challenged to get back to the moon by 2018, I think, by George Bush in 2002. So is it going to get there?
No, not in the budget it's got now. Absolutely not. And I don't think Obama wants it particularly to go to the moon. And I can't for any reason see why it would want to go back to the moon. It's quite a ludicrous idea. Hmm. In fact, the main decisions that have to be made are about the International Space Station, because it's technically only got another 5 or 6 years of life left. So $100 billion will have been spent building this thing. Then 5 years later, they junk it, which seems an extraordinary.
And it's achieved much, hasn't it?
It has a diddly squid, I think we could say it's achieved. Yeah. So NASA has got an immense problem.
Well, that's NASA, but what about the rest of the space industry? I mean, there's going to be huge numbers of people going into space privately, probably this decade.
Well, this is what people feel is actually the future for space travel. It's kind of the equivalent of when the aeroplane was invented and lots of little entrepreneurs went off and developed better and better aeroplanes. I think a lot of them killed themselves in the process, which kind of we don't kind of quite feel is such an open opportunity here, particularly if you're going flying Virgin Galactic. So it's got that kind of problem. But yes, there are all these SpaceX, Virgin Galactic, all flying suborbital flights. Could they perhaps be the people that take us into orbit in the future and get around this terrible problem of that NASA's in? Could it take the strain off NASA?
Well, I mean, Virgin Galactic's design for Spaceship Two does allow them to take satellites up into low Earth orbit. So it's not just about sending tourists up there.
I mean, everybody's got long-term goals, but I mean, they haven't actually flown commercially yet, so let's wait and see what happens.
Are you positive about the future for space, David?
Well, I was just going to think it's very interesting that within 18 months or so, NASA could just about be the only people who can't put someone in space, because the Europeans can do it, the Russians are going to be able to do it, the Chinese can do it, we're going to have all these private companies that can do it, and poor old NASA will be sat there with its mothballed space shuttles and its blueprints for a new rocket, and we'll have to go cap in hand to everybody else to get its people to the space station. I think I'm quite excited about the space station, actually. I've written about this many times, and finally it's sort of up to speed, and finally we're going to have a full crew on there, and finally we'll get to find out about how those crystals grow in space, which is what we've waited all this time for. Hopefully it will teach us a bit more about how people can live in space and perform in space, and I think it will provide a bit more of a window on space, because I mean you'd imagine in the modern communications days that there'll be all sorts of opportunities for people to interact with the people up there, and to I remember as a kid watching the first space shuttle launch, and it had a big impact. And I think if you're being generous, you could argue that the space station could do that. It could be sort of the world's window on the rest of space. Yeah.
Yeah. But just one final point then. Perhaps we shouldn't be looking to NASA then in that case for the future of space. Perhaps we should be looking east. I mean, China seems to be powering ahead.
Yes. Yes. But again, why it wants to land on the moon still remains a mystery.
Well, why you'd want to, that's a mystery. But they might do it, and they might actually do it quicker and be prepared to take all those risks that people need to do to do this. Well, and India's doing the same. They're looking for vyomanauts, I think they're calling them, rather than astronauts.
This is NASA's paralyzed by this kind of, it can't take risks. It's not allowed to go and put American lives in jeopardy. But you can't go into space without, you know, brave men and women putting their lives on the line.
Okay. We said we wouldn't talk about this, but we're going to a little bit. Climate.
Yay!
Which David's been aching to talk about now. So Copenhagen failed, but what's going to happen next? Where's the next junket?
Well, it didn't fail. I mean, this is...
Oh, come on, it did.
The hype about Copenhagen is in danger of being matched by the hype about what a disaster it was. I think you have to put Copenhagen in the context of this sort of grindingly slow, very difficult, massively bureaucratic process that's been going on for years and years and years. And yes, it failed in the sense that it was set a deadline to agree a binding treaty, and it hasn't done that. So technically it's failed, but it hasn't failed in the fact that it's the grindingly slow process is still grinding on.
Okay.
It's almost a bit like a tightrope walk. Every step forward is progress as long as you don't fall off, and the process didn't fall off. Where we go now, I think, is a little bit of an open question. The big event this year, I think, is going to be the domestic bill in the US. Can they get something through the Senate, which looks anything like a meaningful cap and trade agreement? If they can, then that gives the Obama administration a bit of confidence, I think. And there is stuff going on behind the scenes. I think... You know, there are people who talk about a bilateral agreement between the US and China would basically lead the whole thing to unlock. And I think you have to look there beyond climate change. There's something in the wider geopolitical world that will happen between the US and China that will allow the climate change talks to proceed, if at all.
When is the next sort of deadline, though? I mean, the thing about Copenhagen was there was a deadline there. They had to do something. So when's the next one of those?
Well, I don't think there is one. I think the Copenhagen deadline was set in Bali 2 years before. That's now passed. It's expired. Copenhagen did not set a deadline. In itself, there is, of course, a gigantic global deadline, because if we don't start to cut emissions soon, if emissions don't peak within a few, 4 or 5 years, then we haven't got a hope in hell of getting anywhere near 2 degrees.
All right, let's talk about something more positive, the Large Hadron Collider. Robin, are we going to actually find this Higgs boson finally, eventually?
Well, if they don't, that'd be a corker if they don't.
It would be good news, though, wouldn't it? It'd be like proper new physics. Rather than what you expect.
That's it. I mean, I think if you actually asked most scientists at CERN what they want something that's completely unexpected. They don't want to find the Higgs boson in its predicted range or WIMPs in their predicted range. They want, as you say, new physics, something completely startling and unexpected.
Paid for it wanted to find the Higgs boson, don't they?
Well, I don't, the people who paid for it don't have a clue why it's there.
They can be told that the Higgs boson's there. They won't know.
Yeah. On the other hand, it'd be quite nice for Professor Higgs if his boson was found. It'd be a nice Nobel Prize for him.
Yeah. But the Large Hadron Collider, the Higgs boson, whether it finds that or not, is just the beginning of what that can do.
Yes.
There's going to be a whole decade of new data, which will take further decades to analyse, and all sorts of interesting things will come out of that.
And keep us in jobs for another decade.
Keep us in jobs for another decade, that's right. And actually, there'll be new physics to report rather than just biology, which is my next question. Genetics, neuroscience, all these things, this is really the decade that technology in this area jumps off, and we're going to be able to sequence genomes in a day, perhaps, not for very much money. There might even be a greater understanding of the brain. I mean, there's going to be a million stories here in the next 10 years.
Well, I mean, yes, starting with Craig Venter, of course, and his Cynthia. This is the synthetic organism that he's apparently going to announce this year. Yes, all sorts of prospects from genetics and the ability to manipulate DNA, and a suitable number of horror stories and scare stories to go with it, no doubt.
Well, the one of the things that hopefully will happen this year is that the first stem cell clinical trials of embryonic stem cell treatments. I think the US biotech company Geron is looking at using those for people with spinal cord injuries. But this is quite an exciting area, using people's own cells to treat things that have never been able to be treated before.
Yes, and stem cell surgery offers enormous benefits. It's like a lot of things, though. It's all tantalizingly just out of range of immediate practical use. We're still waiting.
All right, well, both of you, we'll wind up this section with just asking, if we're sat here again in 10 years' time in this podcast studio, heaven forbid, and we're discussing the best things out of the 2010s, David, what would you have hoped would have happened in this decade?
Well, I'm going to put my climate hat back on and pray that they can make ITER work, the fusion reactor that they're building in France. I don't know if it's meant to be ready by 2020 or not, but Robin's nodding his head, which is good. Because I think we're in a real mess, and I don't think we're going to cut emissions unless we find a cheap source of energy that everyone can use. And fusion, it looks like the only idea on the drawing board at the moment.
Okay, Robin? Yeah, if fusion's always in 50 years away, so yes. If that doesn't work...
Yes, fusion's a good... I'm hoping for really good results on the decoding of the Neanderthal genome, and then comparing that with that of Homo sapiens, and understanding exactly why they were evolutionary failures and we were evolutionary successes, if you like to think of us as successes. So to understand the difference between humans and Neanderthals, I think, is crucial in understanding ourselves, and that will give us a real kind of lever into appreciating what it means to be Homo sapiens.
I think it also talks into that issue that the first 10 years of this century, I suppose, have been about cataloguing genetics and DNA, understanding the technology of it. But the next 10 years is actually going to start providing meaning and context and understanding and comparisons between all these things. What these things actually mean, why one species was successful and one wasn't. So
yes.
Actually useful information from it rather than just we've done the sequence.
Yeah, we've done the boring bit. Now let's get the exciting bit on the road.
All right, well, we'll leave that there. Whatever does happen this year, you'll be able to read about it on guardian.co.uk/science. And if websites still exist in a decade, you can find out there if any of Robin's or David's wishes have come true. My thanks to the guests this week, Robin McKee and David Adam. We're back next week with more interviews and news. This podcast was produced by Pete Sale. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening.